Hello, and welcome to another thrilling episode of My Dog Will Eat My Face. Well, I am actually still here. I've been away for a little bit, dealing with a new medical director that is, I guess, trying to make waves and announce that she is the new boss as she takes over in her position at my hospice provider. Now, what has since happened, I guess since when I last broadcast, is we actually did conduct a quote-unquote family meeting with the good doctor and my nurse to discuss, I suppose, what her thoughts were and what was at hand for me. Some of it is not in the slightest bit surprising. Some other parts of it, I guess you could say, were surprising. I will end the suspense immediately and say, no, I was not kick-dropped out of hospice. As was my ultimate fear. Now, that may yet happen, as I will soon explain. But, at least, as of this moment, there is no change in, I guess, my status. But I was, to some extent, pleasantly surprised with the doctor's observation, I suppose, of my rather unique predicament. And in fact, my unique anatomy, which is in no sense an exaggeration. You know, everyone kind of thinks they're a special snowflake these days, but I assure you, this unique anatomy thing is not part of that. It's part of an actual fact. It's based on some actual studies that have been done on my body over the years and the various interventions that my cardiologist has done in previous years, to where, sure, you add them all together and it's absolutely a unique anatomy to some extent. It's not like I'm growing a goat's horn out of my butt cheeks or anything bizarre like that. God. It's got everything to do just with blood circulation and heart and lung pressures and things of that nature. So don't worry, I am still human. And it's nothing weird and outrageous, but it is unique and needs to be accounted for. And I was actually glad that she did account for that. I assume, though, that came out of her discussion with my cardiologist, because the term unique anatomy is something that I am merely parroting from my cardiologist. He's the one that told me I had a unique anatomy. And my guess is he said it to her as well. So, I think it took some discussion with my cardiologist for her to, I guess, come to understand what is meant by that phrase. And again, I will certainly elaborate on that here a little bit further within this podcast. But fundamentally, at this time, nothing has changed. And while that in and of itself is comforting, there is really no guarantee with this doctor that that will remain the case. And so there is yet to be seen what may come about from this person trying to ruffle everyone's feathers in a new job. I sincerely think that's what she's doing, and I think she's just conducting a lot of CYA. And I will most certainly explain to you, the good listener, why I think that. So, stick around, and I'll try as best as I can to expand on these various points. So allow me to begin with just a little bit of history. If you've been a listener for some time, I'm sure you know all, if not most, of this already. But bear with me. I'm certain that when the new medical director spoke to my cardiologist, she was told at least some, if not all of this, perhaps more even, I don't know. But based on her veneer, when I first met her, to how she was subsequently in a family-wide discussion, she seemed to have picked up some very lucid points that likely came from my cardiologist, who was my cardiologist, mind you, for years and years, well before I was in hospice, and he knows my body very well. He's done interventions, he's put implants inside my body. He's pretty darn familiar. But I'm sure that he had a lot of splaining to do, Lucy, so to speak, to this talker. So, it all goes back to the beginning, as all good books do. Bad joke, sorry. I didn't mean to get biblical there. But it does. It does all go back to my very beginning, my birth. When I was essentially born without a right pulmonary artery. So I often tell people if they're in a parking lot somewhere and they see a right pulmonary artery like laying on the ground, that's probably mine. So they should probably bag it and bring it to me. Anyway, it's an important piece of material to be missing at it as you're born. And it resulted basically with me turning blue all the time when I was newly born. They didn't know why. And so what they did is they did an open heart surgery, not knowing what exactly they were going to find, actually. And that's when they, lo and behold, found that there was no right pulmonary artery. And they sort of had to scramble in the lab on what to do about it, because the usual procedure back then would be to graft an artery or a part of an artery from another part of the body and place it to where the missing vessel should be. But I was born premature and I was so small, my entire body could fit in the palm of your hand. I was told this, mind you. I have no recollection, obviously, of this. I was a baby. Give me a break. But I was too small for a graft. So what they had to do is quickly assemble an artificial shunt to implant where the artery was supposed to be, just using material they had happened to have in the OR. And lo and behold, I was one of the very first people on Earth to get a fully artificial implant. So I'm told. And That seemed to help, but I grew up with this implant. And to this day, as I talk to you now, that same shunt is still there. Last I heard, it's actually even still working. But it's very old, obviously. And it's something made for a 1-year-old, maybe. Not an adolescent, even. Not a teenager. Not a 20-something. Not an adult male. Okay? So, right off the bat, it's too small. And it's been highly calcified and kind of encrusted over the years, over the decades it's been there. So there is remarkably, last I heard, and this was maybe actually up to 10 years ago. So it might have changed since then, but I don't think it's changed. I think I'd be dead if it changed. But there's still a blood flow through it, but they had no opportunity to, say, balloon it or expand it because it was just so brittle and calcified that they were afraid if they were to just nudge it, it would just fall apart and bam, cardiac arrest. So I grew up with this piece in me getting older and older, too small and too smaller yet as I got bigger. And that obviously resulted in an enlarged heart and somewhat underdeveloped lungs. For example, my lower lobes of both lungs are still very underdeveloped, is how I would describe it. There is a lower lobe, mind you, but it's it's not much. There ain't much to it. So it's been a challenge to my body to grow with that. Later, much, much later, decades later, my cardiologist found that I had a protein C deficiency. And what that does is it creates anomalous blood clotting and occlusion in blood vessels that can render them pretty much completely blocked off. And at the time, on one leg, my femoral artery, the main artery going into the leg, was completely missing. And in the other leg, it was still there, but it was completely occluded. And from what he could tell, was slowly being reabsorbed by the body, which is likely what happened to the other leg's femoral artery. And very well could be what happened to my right pulmonary artery before even birth. Now, for decades when I was growing up, I don't think they even had such a thing discovered as a protein C deficiency. So That's more relatively new science that's come about to discover that. So at the time, they really just didn't know what the heck they were dealing with, and they were just winging it. But he being my cardiologist, did a couple times successfully put in a couple stents to improve the blood flow to my heart and lungs. And then another study, an atomic study showing perforation of oxygen into the lungs at another facility showed that one lung was working fine and the other was basically not there. I have both lungs, but one lung, it's only getting oxygen perforated to maybe the top 10% of the lung. And that's it. So, I'm also living off of one lung, basically. So, it's a less than ideal situation, needless to say. But, amazingly, my body has furiously adapted the best it could. In lieu of these major blood vessels that are now missing or deficient or occluded, they found just a jumbled mess, a cobweb-like mass of peripheral blood vessels, that's what they call them, that my body had generated on its own over time to make up for the loss of blood flow and oxygen to my body. It's both in my legs, they saw it, and also in my chest around the heart and lungs. And they showed me scanned pictures of this, and it just literally looked like a spider web, just like this mess, this menagerie of tubing, and just a total mess, a jumbled ball of blood vessels going every which way and then the other, and just a mess. So that's remarkable in my opinion. My body adapted as best as it could to these conditions. And it was probably that adaption that led me to live a relatively normal life for most of my life. I went to school. I went to PE. God, I traveled much of the world. I've done many things. I'd fly. If anything, my life was above normal, I would say. I usually went above and beyond what most people do. Not the antithesis of being relegated back to a bed or immobile or anything else of that nature. But my cardiologist worded it to me very simply. I am absolutely no candidate for surgery and any further intervention. And that's for two reasons. One, the pressures in my heart and lungs are so high. The mortality rate is just excessively high if they were to try to do surgery. To where no reasonable, I guess, put that in quotation marks, surgical team would dare cut into the area around the chest for fear of that causing my immediate death. And more so to that, the peripheral blood vessels that are just caked around these areas, they have no idea what vessel they could clip, and nothing really happens. Or they clip it, and then I go into immediate cardiac arrest. And everywhere in between, they have no idea. Which again precludes me even further from any additional intervention or surgery. And to underscore it even further, the very last heart catheterization I've had, I was an adult, and I was in the recovery room, and my cardiologist walked in, and he boldly announced, "I'm even more confused now than I was before I started." Which is not what you want to hear from your cardiologist. That's kind of like right up there with your cardiologist asking the nurse to leave the room and give you and him some privacy. Which also happened around then. That's the short version of my unique anatomy. And he is the one, actually, my cardiologist is the one who booted me to hospice originally. And he even did explain to me that they find that when people get put in hospice, they actually live longer than they were otherwise expected to live because of the drive for comfort. You're not stressing the body out with constant surgeries and hack jobs, and you're not struggling all the time. You have relief because comfort is the focus, not remediation of the symptoms, just comfort. And just giving the body that reprieve to chill. That's my word. I don't think I ever heard my cardiologist say chill, although he probably did. Giving your body a chance to chill out has actually been proven to expand people's longevity. Now, truth being told, I'm sure he was thinking, in my case, maybe 8 months instead of 6. Not 4.5 years versus 6 months. I mean, that blew it out of the water. I mean, so I am probably... at this point, if not approaching one of the longest denizens of hospice care that has ever been, you'll find stories online of people that make it 4 years, maybe 4.5. Well, I'm slowly approaching 5. Maybe at some point I need to get Guinness in here. Not the beer, but although that's not a bad idea. But the Book of World Records. See if I can make a world record for myself. Longest time in hospice. Without croaking. So. That's the history. And where we are today. Now enter a brand new medical director for my hospice team. She immediately met with all the long-timers, the folks that have been in hospice for a very long period of time. Now, I actually don't know if I'm the longest one they have in hospice, but I'm in whatever tier it is of folks that I guess are well past what should have been their senior year, so to speak. But she really wanted to make waves and be sure that these people were not misusing hospice with Medicare because it's so heavily regulated, she said. Now, you can read the federal guidelines on hospice care in about 30 minutes. And she tried to make it sound like, this is just my opinion, she tried to make it sound like it was the most heavily regulated thing in the world. Like she had never imagined such government oversight as this. Well, I guess that's one perspective. It's definitely not my perspective. I had a career in legal compliance where I had to deal with a menagerie of federal, state, and local laws, sometimes that contradict one another, and sometimes that just don't make sense. And for each of these, we're talking hundreds of pages of statutory requirements. And then on top of that, regulatory requirements. And then on top of that, best practices. And so on and so on. So I just thought to myself, oh, lady, you're not scaring me with your one-page federal guidelines. Try dealing with the FCRA and the DPPA and the GLBA. If you're not in the data world, you have no clue what I'm talking about, so I'm just going to shut up. But for all my friends out there that are in the data world, in the data regulation world, they all probably cracked a smile. So anyway, that's just for them. Where was I? Yeah, so she kept alluding to these guidelines. And my father, God bless him, he pointed out something so painfully obvious at the end of this family conference call that we had, that if I was close enough to him, I would high-five him. I'll get to that later, though. What she said, simply put, was that she needs more data. And sure, that's reasonable, I would say, especially when you're tipping over 4 or 5 years of hospice care. I think that is a reasonable request, and I'm just being honest. So she wanted me to follow up with my cardiologist to get an echo and an echocardiogram and clinic visit in with him. So I'm currently struggling to get that done, because to get those things done, it's generally going to be 8 months out, first availability. So I don't know what she's thinking. Like, I can just call up my cardiologist and make an appointment as though he's my PCP or something. I don't know, but I know for a fact my cardiologist is sought after around the world. He is an expert at what he does. That's why I picked him. He's hard to come by. And it's going to take some time to get in to see him. Now, they're trying to get some strings pulled to where I might be able to get in sooner. But I have not yet heard how that's going to be. And I need to state this issue on Tuesday to my nurse to repeat to the doctor that I don't think she understood the timelines we were looking at, because my hospice care is going to expire most likely before I can get in to do those things she wants me to do. So what do we do about that? And that's the first problem. Now, the other thing is of course I've been following my cardiologist. For years I've been following him. And he is the one who put me in hospice in the first place. And what's more, I reached out to him in writing when this issue came up. And I asked him point blank, are there any new procedures or processes or treatments that might help my situation? Because if there are, that's a whole other game I'm playing. If there are, then I want to hear more about that. Independent of this hospice doctor or anything, obviously I don't want to keel over and die. Independent of any of that, I'd love to hear more about that. If there's something out there. Sadly, the answer was no. He wrote back in writing, he said, no, there are no new treatments. There are new medications out there, but considering your issues, again, my unique anatomy, mind you. He doesn't think they will help. And I do have that in writing. And I express that to my family and to the doctor. She was still adamant, saying she wants more data. So, getting back to my father and what he said on the phone on this family conference. It was just so obvious and beautifully put. I wish I recorded it. Because no matter how I do it, I'm not going to be able to paraphrase it in the right inflection and terminology that he uses. But, oh well, I'll try. He said, this all sounds like a bunch of busy work when we already know the answer. And the doctor, I think, asked him to say again, like to clarify, and he said, yeah. He already emailed his cardiologist. He knows the answer. Why are we going through all this hoopla when we already know the answer? Why is this any different from the past 4 years where every single time the certification was renewed? It's the same situation. This is a bunch of busy work when there's no change and we already know the answer. And you're making my son go through all this stress and figure out how to get there and to carry oxygen with him and get home and all this other logistical nightmare stuff you're taking for granted and making him do all this work and stress, which is the last thing you should do to a heart patient, when we know the frickin' answer. And I gotta tell you, the doctor's response was not very impressive. She said again, simply, I need more data, period. I'm not going to extend it without more data. In other words, she stuck her fingers in her ears and blew raspberries back. That's all she did. In my book, to answer this legitimate statement from my father. Don't want to hear it. And, of course, that's because she is just practicing CYA. And doesn't give a damn about how it affects me. And that's just sad. So, unfortunately, that is more or less where we left the family call. I'm still in hospice. I've heard multiple different dates as to for how long I'm certified for. One was as close as just the 19th of this month. Well, another I keep hearing is September, 6 months from now. So I'm not really sure which it is. If it's the 19th, this doctor might as well ask for a unicorn while she's at it, because there's no way I'm going to get this all worked out and to see my cardiologist. With an echo, too. Because they're all backed up to 8 months as well. I checked. I just can't imagine that happening before April 19th, which is one date I was given. So what does she do? Let it just expire and meet? I don't know. Lose all my medication and I don't know what. Die? I don't know what. Does she renew it just one more frickin' time to get to the data that she wants to get? I don't know. To me, that seems like that might be worth it. Because then she could have her cake and eat it too. but if she is refusing to even do one little renewal just to get the data she wants, then I don't know where that leaves us. So, needless to say, we enter the future with a lot of uncertainty. While I do have some relief in that I was not punted to the curb yet, I've been sworn to by both the doctor and my nurse that they won't just leave me hanging. They will make sure I get my meds somehow. And palliative care, if that's what is necessary. But a lot of questions. Simple questions. And important questions have yet to be answered. So, me, being me, of course, ended the call with a very familiar quote to me. You all know how I love quotes from people when I pepper them in my brain for certain meanings and motivations and references. At the end of that call, I remembered one such quote that relates to uncertainty. The unknown of what may yet come and how it will work out. So I said, the decision will come from God, the God of battles, when he lets fall from his hand the iron dice of destiny. And I ended the call. Now, the doctor and the nurse who were in the room with me gave me a very terrified look, as you might expect. And I just said, what? It's Otto von Bismarck on uncertainty. What's the big deal? They quickly left my home. So there we have it, folks. That is my current situation. I don't know, obviously, how this will turn out. But at least I can say today, is okay. I'm safe today, as far as I know. But I don't know how this will shape up. As things move forward. But truthfully, that's not so different from anyone else in this world, is it? But needless to say, I have decided, actually, to keep broadcasting the podcast. For now, at least. I know I was unsure if I would pull the plug on it or not. But truth being told, my incessant rambling is actually therapeutic for me, more so than any other benefit, I would say. And that may very well be reason enough to keep it afloat, at least for a while. But I definitely want to thank all those listeners who did reach out to me and extend their 2 cents, their opinion, and of course to you and all other listeners who truly, at least give me some sort of voice in this mess. Because if it wasn't for you listening, after all, I'd just be a madman talking into a wall for naught. And ain't nobody got time for that. So thank you for your support and your listenership. I truly appreciate it. And I do hope to keep things moving. As I navigate what appears to be totally unmapped territory. One last thing, though. My doctor, that is the hospice medical director, did say that the life I live is dramatically different from all their other patients in the exact same scenario. And she credited it. Gosh, say that five times fast. I'm not even gonna try. She credited it with. Sorry. Was she described as my grit and just sheer strength, which she said is something she had never seen before in her life. Well, that is a compliment, I suppose. I know it's not entirely true. Sure. There is some grit, maybe. There is some strength, certainly. But it's not just me grinding my teeth and mashing them and sheer will to overcome nature. That'd be far too Nietzschean of me, after all. I think there's a lot more to it. And I think the biggest factor that has allowed me to live a different life despite my wounds is the time I take for self-reflection and studying those who had long since come and fought and died before me, and seeing what I could learn from their example. In other words, I think a big part of my strength is the self-reflection I do here in this podcast. And that is probably the biggest reason why I'm not yet in a position to cease doing that. The future will yet see how this turns out. But for now, I will bid you adieu and hope to speak to you again soon, perhaps with maybe even just some sense of good news. Because I'll take whatever I can get.